refrigerator or air conditioner help tip the world into massive heating? Yes, says expert Gus Velders, as billions more units are sold in the developing world if we use the same chemicals. Dr. Gus Velders is an expert's expert. He works at the Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency as a senior scientist on ozone depletion, climate change, and air quality. Velders advises the Dutch government, the European Environment Agency, and makes assessments for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the United Nations Environment Program, and more. So, Gus Velders, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's hard to believe small amounts of chemicals in my fridge or air conditioner could have a big impact on the climate in coming decades. We will get to those details, but can you give us a quick thumbnail? How serious is this refrigerant problem?
I think it is serious. You talk about small amounts. I think in a refrigerator there's a few ounces are in there of refrigerant, but the effect on climate is a few thousand times more powerful than that of other gases. So it's not so much the amount of the chemicals, but it's the power of the molecules itself to affect climate.
Right. Well, that's something that we learned a long time ago from the Irish scientist John Tyndall. As early as 1860, he found out that tiny amounts of chemicals could change the heat-trapping ability in the atmosphere. So now we're using relatively new chemicals, though, CFCs and HFCs. Maybe we should lay that groundwork. Could you talk to us just for a minute about what CFCs are and their role in damaging the ozone?
Yeah, I'm always a bit careful with doing interviews talking about all the chemicals, because you so easily confuse all the chemicals when you talk about CFCs and then HCFCs and HFCs. So let's try to split it up. I usually talk about, for the past, about the ozone-depleting chemicals, and then compounds like CFC-11, CFC-12. Those were the powerful ozone-depleting gases which have been used until a few years ago. Those gases are now almost globally phased out, so they cannot be used anymore, and they've been replaced by other chemicals, which some still have an effect on the ozone layer, so still are ozone-depleting gases, but other compounds don't have any effect on the ozone layer. So it's a transition from using different chemicals, which all affect climate, but a different flavor for the ozone layer. So it's a different mix of gases they're using now.
So after the Montreal Protocol, it was first agreed in 1987, I know it's still being developed, the cooling industry provided a replacement that was safe for consumers but not for the climate. Gus, could you tell us about HFCs?
Yeah, I should first say that HFCs, so those are similar gases like the CFCs, the ozone-depleting chemicals, only they've replaced in the molecules the chlorine and bromine atoms with fluorine and hydrogen atoms, which makes them harmless to the ozone layer, but still powerful negative effects for climate. I should also say that the chemical industry did not only replace the chemicals, they also changed the whole design of a lot of equipment. So a lot of equipment like the same chemicals used to be used in hairsprays, but that's completely banned already. None of these chemicals have been used anymore. And also other applications where they completely switched to different technologies instead of using different chemicals. So a large part of the switch was not different to the same type of chemicals, but in completely new technologies.
Well, what I don't understand is, as the Montreal Protocol went through several revisions in the 1990s, didn't the signatories know HFCs in particular were radical greenhouse gases?
I'm not exactly sure when they realized it, but it was known from the beginning, also when they designed the Montreal Protocol, that these gases, the ozone-depleting gases and also their replacement chemicals, they were also potent greenhouse gases, so they did have effect on climate. And even in the original intent, the letters of the Montreal Protocol, and also the Vienna Convention, which came laid the ground for the Montreal Protocol, climate consideration was put in the text there. So the parties were aware that their actions also had an influence on climate.
And moving to 2009, you said the Montreal Protocol may have accomplished more to control climate change than even the first stage or commitment of the Kyoto Protocol, but you warned we needed to rein in HFCs or lose that progress, and you said HFC emissions could be equivalent to 6 or even 8 billion tons of carbon dioxide by 2010. Do we know how much of these gases are escaping these days?
We know quite well how much is escaping because we measure the concentrations of the gas in the atmosphere. And from there we can derive how much is being emitted. And like you said, what we've calculated a few years ago is that the Montreal Protocol was not only beneficial for the ozone layer, but especially also for the climate treaty, and much more effective than the Kyoto Protocol for climate was. And then the side effect is that because of the Montreal Protocol, the different chemicals like HFCs are being used, and they have then a more negative effect. So we might lose the benefit we got from the Montreal Protocol. We might lose if we don't take any additional action or voluntary action or whatever.
Well, in my reading of the graphs that were in your 2009 paper, and I'm only doing this roughly, HFC consumption by developing countries appears to reach the same levels as we have in the developed countries pretty soon, around 2015 or 2018. And then the radiative forcing, which is what really counts here from HFC use in those developing countries, would equal all the developed countries a little bit later, maybe 25 or 2030. And then it takes off in a big, steep curve upwards that indicates big impacts on the climate could happen.
That's, of course, a scenario we have. We don't know exactly what will happen. We assumed that what you now already see in Asia, that there's a large economic growth and large population growth, and population growth in China like 8 or 9% per year. And when that continues for a couple of years, and then we don't need 8 or 9%, but we assumed on average something like 3 or 4% per year. And that in combination with the large population growth, well, refrigerators and air conditioners are something, it's a luxury product. When you get a bit more wealthy, then you'd like to have a refrigerator, especially if you, when you live in Asia. So it's something which is likely to happen also in those countries, like it happened in the U.S. and in Europe a couple of years ago. So it's likely that with the combination of the large population growth and economic development, those countries will start consuming more and more compounds which could use HFCs.
Well, we were told by another guest, Stan Cox, that the air conditioning in Mumbai alone uses about 40% of all the electricity used by that big city. So they're sprouting up all over Asia.
I've heard similar numbers, yeah. And that's in air conditioning. And also look at the refrigeration. I've heard numbers that about the same in Mumbai, that about half of the crop which is harvested on the land gets lost because it cannot be refrigerated. So it's likely that when you get a bit more money, that you like a cooling so you can keep your food in good shape before it gets to the market.
Well, all of us want that. We've got it, so probably it's going to happen there.
Exactly.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is climate and ozone expert Gus Velders from the Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency. How are HFCs and other refrigerants escaping from consumer and commercial air conditioners and refrigeration? How do they reach the atmosphere?
For example, HFCs are now the standard refrigerant in the mobile air conditioning. That's a very classical one. And clearly, in a car, everything is shaking. It's very difficult to keep it tight. And their leakage rate, so from the chart you have in there, that about 15% leaks every year out of your car from the refrigerant, and you have to replace it. And, of course, when you have a home refrigerator, it's much more stable. There's much less leakage. But then at the end of life, you have to make sure that it's not just put on a landfill or being shipped to Africa, but that you take care of the refrigerant and you remove it and destroy it or you reuse it.
Well, Gus Velders, are refrigerants being collected effectively in Europe or North America?
I know in my own country, in the Netherlands, I know the ozone-depleting gases must be collected. Refrigerant itself, I don't think it has to be. And I'm not sure about the U.S. and Canada, but I'm pretty sure that in a lot of the less developing countries, it's not collected. And that's where we're expecting the large growth. So if you don't develop also your regulation with the economic development, you might lose what you gained before.
Right, and you've projected, if I'm getting this right, that refrigerants accumulating in the atmosphere by 2050 could add another 14 to 27% to the increased warming from all human-made carbon dioxide emissions. Now, did I get that right?
I believe we use a number, in a radiative forcing, we use a number like 10 to 20%. That's usually what I quote.
But that's, you know, going forward, we're saying refrigerants could add 20% or more to the impacts of current use of runaway use of fossil fuels all over the world. It sounds like a recipe for disaster, climate disaster to me. What can be done about this?
What can be done? There are things which are being negotiated internationally by among the Montreal Protocol and by the Kyoto Treaty. But international negotiations are going very slowly, especially when you look at climate the last couple of years. So parties have proposed to include controls on HFCs under the Montreal Protocol. And there's strong support for it by some countries, like they have been proposed by the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and by Micronesia. but also strong opposition by several Asian countries. And also because in the Montreal Protocol, it was always good progress because it was a successful treaty and parties would like to participate in a successful treaty. But now when the climate negotiations, in fact, entered the Montreal Protocol, everything became much more complicated. Other people came in there, other negotiators, and there's some sort of deadlock now with these negotiations.
And there's a series of articles in the New York Times that suggest that there are much safer chemicals, at least for the climate, available right now. Have you heard about that?
Yeah. Not for all applications, but for a large number of sectors, there are very good alternatives already commercially available. It's not in all circumstances, but in a lot of circumstances, you can use commercially ready alternatives. And like you said, if you look at insulation in buildings, when you use mineral wool instead of an HFC for the insulation for making the walls, well, you don't have any indirect effect from the chemicals, any direct effect from the chemicals. And also in other applications, like refrigeration, air conditioning, you can use hydrocarbons. In my refrigerator at home, there's a hydrocarbon in there, which is small unit, very safe. In other applications, you're using ammonia or even CO2 as a coolant, as a refrigerant. Of course, it depends on where you use it. You don't want to use ammonia, which is toxic, in an environment which can be exposed to people. But when you can build it this way, that you have some somewhere outside a building and then transport the cooled air inside, you can still do it safe. So there are a lot of applications where it's already possible to use alternatives which are good for both the ozone layer and for climate.
This is Radio EcoShock with Dutch scientist Gus Velders. While we have you on the line, I know you're a published expert on the relationships between ozone and climate change. In fact, you were a lead author in an IPCC special report on that subject. And it stumps many people. I get countless well-meaning people saying we have to stop the ozone hole to save the planet from climate change. Can you talk to us about the relationship between those two subjects?
I know for the public it's always very confusing. In my view, it's you have to first consider them separately. The ozone layer is caused by chlorine and bromine chemicals, man-made, which are going into the atmosphere and which reach altitudes like between 12 and 20 kilometers. And there they destroy the ozone, which protects us from harmful ultraviolet radiation. That's a different issue than climate. Climate is, at first instance, caused by emissions from greenhouse gases, and most notably, it's CO2, also largely man-made, but different gas. But of course, we're talking about one atmosphere and there are all sorts of interactions. So climate change affects how the ozone layer recovers. And these ocean-depleting gases we should be talking about also have an influence on climate. Although it's not a primary gas, it still has a significant influence, which could be 10-20% now and in the future. So it's one atmosphere and there are all sorts of interactions. But in principle, ozone layer and climate change are separate issues.
But it does make it complicated. We're going to have to control several things at once. We have to fight to regulate carbon dioxide and stop using fossil fuels, frankly, and at the same time still work on HFCs as well. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That's also making it in the international negotiations so complicated. I once told a colleague, if you want an agreement which can solve everything, it probably takes forever to get a deal. So the Montreal Protocol is targeted to one group of chemicals and more or less one chemical industry branch, and climate is tackling another group. And keeping it separate is also keeping it a bit more simple. But because of the interactions and the negative interactions, the interactions also come into the negotiations that you have to tackle climate, also in the Montreal Protocol, and you have to consider it both.
Well, that sounds like a reasonable strategy to me. Gus, what are you working on these days?
We're still working on the HFCs now and looking into if we can improve the scenarios which we developed before. Because every few years, we have to see if the scenario developed before, if it's still valid. If there are new developments, new chemicals coming onto the market, and that's the case already for mobile air conditioning, for example. And you want to see if those chemicals don't have other negative side effects. Because now, when in the beginning, you better try to warn the people early on, instead of in 10 years' time to say, hey, you should have done it differently. So we want to keep track of what's developing with the phase-out of the ocean-feeding chemicals and what the chemical industry is doing now.
I think we've taken a reasonable attempt at a difficult subject. Is there something you'd like to say to sort of wrap it up for listeners, something they should remember about this?
I think we've done most of things. Like one thing I told you about the international negotiations now going on, and it's, the difficulty there is that there are developing countries and developed countries which both have a different starting point. I think that's the difficulty in both the climate negotiations and the Montreal Protocol negotiations. Both are at goodwill, but it's hard to, from a different starting point, make a different perspective that you can easily reach the same goal. Maybe it's now more difficult with the financial crisis also, which makes those negotiations even more difficult.
Right. Everybody's struggling. We've been talking with Dr. Gus Velders. He's a senior scientist from the Environmental Protection Agency in the Netherlands and an expert for world bodies working on both ozone protection and climate change. Thank you for lending us your valuable time.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. This is the Radio EcoShock special, heading for air-conditioned hell. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for tuning in. If you missed part of this program, download it later as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. You can pass it around as well. Sign up for our weekly podcast while you are there. The show notes for each program are at ecoshock.info. Dr. Michael Sivak is the Director of Sustainable Worldwide Transportation at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. He's looked at the energy we use to heat and cool, coming up with useful suggestions for where you might want to live, who's next for the air conditioning boom, and how the world should count carbon emissions. Michael, I'd like to take a lightning tour through three of your papers. Let's start with the earliest, Where to Live in the United States, Combined Energy Demand for Heating and Cooling in the 50 Largest Metropolitan Areas. I find that intriguing. Energy costs, with the exception of natural gas, just keep going up, and about 35 million Americans move around anyway. Where should people go to pay the lowest energy bills and reduce their climate footprint?
When you combine the demand for heating and cooling, a clear pattern emerges. First, the least demand for interior climate control is in California. On the other hand, the upper Midwest and Northeast fare the worst.
Well, this paper was published in 2008. Since then, we have had scorching years with milder winters, and there's going to be more of that as the climate changes. According to your paper, from Florida right across the South, Americans already use more energy for cooling than heating. I'm wondering, if the world warms a few degrees, places like New England might require less energy. What do you think?
Yes, that is the case. However, the proportional reduction in the energy used to heat there will be smaller than the increase in the energy used to cool in our hot cities. This is because currently we use more energy to heat in the north than to cool in the south.
All right. And for right now, though, where should people trying to cut their energy bills consider living if they are going to move?
San Diego is by far the best, and Minneapolis the worst.
Were there any surprising findings in this paper?
Yes, indeed. Most people consider living in the desert cities such as Phoenix and Las Vegas to be the worst from the point of view of sustainability. However, the total demand for energy there for climate control is actually less than in northern cities like Minneapolis and Milwaukee. So from this point of view, it is less sustainable to live in Minneapolis than in Phoenix.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Michael Sivak from the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Michael, let's go to the global scale now with your article titled Potential Energy Demand for Cooling in the 50 Largest Metropolitan Areas of the World, Implications for Developing Countries. In the U.S., you found heating homes still used more energy than cooling, as you say. Does that hold true for the biggest world cities?
It turns out that the future pattern for the biggest cities of the world is just the opposite from the current pattern in the U.S., with most of the world's megacities potentially needing more energy to cool than to heat. This will happen once people there will be able to afford air conditioning, because most of these megacities are in developing countries.
And I've just looked at photos and figures for air conditioning in Mumbai, India, the former Bombay. You did a stunning calculation 4 years ago about that potential power demand for cooling just in that one city alone. Can you tell us about that?
As an example of the impending huge increase in the demand for cooling, I used the climatological and population data to estimate the latent demand for air conditioning in Mumbai. The calculations indicate that the potential cooling demand in the city of Mumbai is about a quarter of the demand for the entire United States.
Just that one city alone?
Yep. Scary statistics.
I traveled throughout India in the late 1970s, and hardly anything was air-conditioned. Hotels had those giant ceiling fans in every room. And now cooling gobbles up more electricity than they can produce, blacking out big power grids. Why is the developing world going full speed into air conditioning?
For the same reason that we are doing it, namely comfort in the first place, followed by health and productivity.
Is there any science to say that productivity increases once you cool buildings down?
Yes, there is some evidence indicating that people are more productive in a certain range of temperatures.
And after India and China, where is the biggest potential growth of this demand for cooling?
The next in line are Indonesia, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Brazil, and the Philippines. Each has the potential to exceed the energy used for air conditioning in the United States.
Each one of those countries?
Yes.
Wow. Well, now more people are living in cities than in rural areas, and that trend is accelerating. We know leafy natural landscapes add cooling, while cities develop that heat island effect that you mentioned, which raises temperatures several degrees. And when we add in the trend that you also mentioned towards higher incomes and global warming, I worry people will need air conditioning in cities just to survive, and that will make climate change and energy shortages even worse. Michael Sivak, do you share that concern?
Very much so. However, I do not see any easy solutions because it would be very difficult to ask people in developing countries to forego amenities that we have been privileged to use for a long time.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Michael Sivak from the University of Michigan. Perhaps you've seen listeners' rankings of countries based on their emissions per capita. Michael Sivak says those aren't fair unless we also count each nation's real need for heating and cooling. That's in a recent publication in American Scientist, written with Brandon Shuttle. This article is called Accounting for Climate in Ranking Countries' Carbon Dioxide Emissions. In a way, Michael, this builds on your earlier studies. You seem to be saying people in other countries have a right to be as comfortable as we are. If we ever agree on a fair distribution of greenhouse gas emissions, we have to count it in. I'm sure you can explain it better than that. What is this paper about?
The basic premise of the paper is that the population of a country cannot choose the local climate. Generally, people live where they live because the mobility of most people in other countries of the world is rather limited. Therefore, in ranking countries on the amount of emissions, we need to also consider the local climate. This is the case because climate control itself generates emissions. So in this paper, we divided emissions per capita and per GDP in a given country by a climatological measure that takes into account the extent of the need to heat and cool.
And calculating those carbon allowances based on heating and cooling seems like common sense, but does this approach necessarily hurt countries like the United States or Britain?
Just the opposite. Doing so improves the ranking for both countries, but both countries end up nowhere near the least emitting countries. From among the 157 countries we examined, the U.S. moved to be the 110th least emitting country and Britain the 58th.
Well, if we shift a country rankings from simple carbon dioxide emissions to factor in that existing climate, the whole view changes. For example, how does Jordan become a heavy emitter while Sweden becomes a low emitter?
This is the case because countries with a large demand for heating and or cooling, such as Sweden, will see an improvement in their ranking. On the other hand, countries with a relatively small demand for climate control, such as Jordan, will usually see a worsening in their ranking.
And how does Australia measure up when we count for emissions produced versus the given climate?
This is a good example. Australia drops from being the 126th best to being the 151st or the 7th worst.
And Michael Sivak, what is next for you? What are you working on now?
I'm looking at the future demand for cooling in all developing countries.
And how will you do that?
this study is an extension of the work I did on cooling demand in the largest metropolitan area. So I'm using the same methodology, but now I'm looking at the entire countries and comparing them to the demand in the U.S. as a yardstick.
Dr. Michael Sivak is the Director of Sustainable Worldwide Transportation at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Michael, thank you so much for talking with us.
Many thanks for having me.
As we feel the rumble of the oncoming climate train, I'm not going to count on prayer alone. Activism and action can preserve a livable world, I believe that. I'm Alex Smith. You can contact me through our website at ecoshock.org.
Is there anywhere left to go? The air is bad, hard to breathe. I can't stay, I can't leave. Every day is a heavy load. With these hot and polluted episodes. Say why it just keeps coming from the sky. Orange sky, pavement flames, birds fall, old hacks found him in his easy chair, but it wasn't easy.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly one in four people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
CJ.